Please turn to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 20. Our text includes 20, 21, and 22. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. And by faith, Joseph, when he expired, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Death. What is it like? We all have to wait until it's our turn to find out. I know this much is true. Death may be like a book that we have yet to check out and read. But when people act defiantly in the face of death, they have no good reason not to be afraid of this enemy. The Bible calls death an enemy, and only the desperate and only the insane choose death. It is true that for the young and the healthy and the successful, death may seem like a distant rumor, something that you do not need to be concerned about. But if truth be told, and if death draws only near enough, every human being does, in fact, fear death. Like children that fear to go into the dark, and rightly so. Now, we must not demean life. We have yet a life to live. We must not demean life by constantly standing in awe of death. But the chips are down. The clock is ticking. Your clock is ticking. It's coming. And along the path of our lives, God places reminders. The death of someone you know, someone who may even be very close to you, is always a reminder that we are still alive for a purpose which we ought to re-examine. Now, we have examined the roll call of faith in Hebrews chapter 11 for quite some time now. Here now, we move on in much briefer sketches. The list continues with scenes from the lives of Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, with a common theme. All three have one foot in the grave. And the authors turned the spotlight on how they died. Faith is tested. And I believe that the ultimate test of faith is death, the last enemy. It's hard to maintain a lie when death approaches. Specious securities evaporate in the presence of death, and any sense of false hope, false security crumbles. Turns into a nightmare. And there are some examples in the history of men where such things became very tangible, very visible, also very discouraging. But the author of Hebrews broaches the subject for a more specific reason. He knows that The readers of this letter, the Hebrews as we are used to calling them, they have already been persecuted for the name. They were people like Bud this morning, who was publicly baptized to profess his faith. They professed their faith and they suffered for it. They have been persecuted, and the author suspects that some of them may have to pay the ultimate price of faith. And so in these three brief sketches, he raises the simple question that we all have to face sooner or later. What does faith do in the face of death? Two of the three men of faith, Isaac and Jacob, father and son, die with blessings on their lips, blessings for their sons. So they think of their future. Joseph exits, speaking about the future exodus of God's people, of Israel. The future orientation of faith is what defines the death of this trio, these three men. And this future orientation of faith entails two ideas. Surrender and assurance. Surrender and assurance. Let's begin with Isaac and the idea that faith surrenders. We read, by faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. Now, as it stands, this does not appear to say much about the nature of faith. But this changes when you consider the entire story that is in its trail. Rebekah's pregnancy with Jacob and Esau, twins, was unusual because they couldn't stop kicking each other in their mother's womb. The Proverbs say, a friend loves at all times, but a brother is born for adversity. And so it was with Jacob and Esau. As soon as they grew legs, they were kicking each other and fought each other, and they couldn't stop. It became so bad that Rebekah eventually addressed God. She sought counsel from God, and she asked him what all of this meant, and God responded with a prophecy. Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within shall be separated. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. And so, when Esau turned out to be the firstborn, separated by only seconds from Jacob, his brother, but when he turned out to be the firstborn, Rebekah knew that Jacob carried the promise of God into the future. The promise belonged to Jacob, the younger. Something like this doesn't happen every day. And you can therefore be sure that sooner or later, she shared this experience with her husband and the father of these boys, with Isaac. There's also a New Testament commentary on this story in Romans chapter 9, verse 10, where the Apostle Paul, under the inspiration of God, the Holy Spirit, says, when Rebekah had conceived by our forefather Isaac, though they weren't yet born and had done nothing, either good or bad, so that God's purpose of election might continue or might be established, not of works, but of him who calls, she was told, the older shall serve the younger, as it is written, Jacob I loved, and Esau I hated. So, Isaac and Rebekah knew that Jacob was the chosen. But time has its way with us, and we tend to be very forgetful, even of the most elementary even of the most defining, even of the most important things in life. And as the boys grew up, they couldn't have been more unlike each other. Jacob loved to stay at home, a quiet and cautious boy, took after his mother, and the two formed a strong bond. Mama taught Jacob how to cook, and his famous stews became the highlight of the week. Esau, on the other hand, was an adventurer, a skillful hunter with a wild-eyed look and blood on his hands. He could be away for days and then return with a kill and a great story to tell. He captured the attention of everyone, and he was the son after Isaac's own heart. He preferred him by a way of natural affinity, and the two formed a strong bond. Now fast forward many years. The boys are men. Isaac has turned blind, and he is dying. So as you heard earlier, he calls Esau and orders him to prepare a meal for him, a festive meal so that he might pronounce the paternal blessing on Esau, although he had known that God had other plans. But Rebecca overhears the conversation, so she makes Jacob wear a disguise and prepare a meal of his own, to act like Esau, to deceive his father, and to snatch away the blessing by guile. And so he does. Shortly after that, Esau shows up, and the scam is discovered. Esau is outraged, and he begs his father to give him the blessing that his brother stole from him. And as if this story was not scandalous enough, Isaac refuses. The blessing remains with the deceiver. Isaac says to Esau, "I have made him lord over you, and by God he shall be blessed. I can't take it back." Well, why not? It seems to me that nothing would be easier than to say, "Let's do this again, shall we? Let's set the record straight." But he doesn't. Isaac knows that his blessing is more than a paternal benediction, as if he would walk off into the golden sunset and say, "May you do well." It is more than just a farewell. It has prophetic power. The words that he spoke to Jacob were words that would come true. This was God's will, God's choice, God's election, God's purpose. And Isaac knew it. He had always known it. Not the least because now, once again, he recalls the words from years ago, "The older shall serve the younger." So here he is, old, broken, blind, outmaneuvered by God's shrewdness. God's shrewdness, God who even worked through the sinful scheme of Rebekah and Jacob to keep the blessing where it was meant to be. And where, if I may ask you, where is faith in all of this? What do we learn about faith in this story? Faith surrenders. Isaac's faith surrenders to God's will. The invincible, sovereign will of God. And this is how our text reads. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau, and by implication, he didn't change them. He surrendered to God. There are many devices in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the counsel of the Lord, it shall stand. This is what Isaac confessed in dying. He was not a man, I don't believe it, he was not a man who fought God tooth and nail all his life. No, but in this thing, he did have his own way. He did have his own mind. And he was contrary to God's purpose. And he surrendered his own will. As if he was saying, God must prevail over me. I want God to prevail over me. God must win. And so not only does Isaac not undo the sinful scheme, but he then knowingly does what he had done unknowingly. Namely, he blesses Jacob with a divine promise, and he publicly confirms his surrender to God's will. You can read about this in Genesis 28, by the way. Now the critical question. Does your faith surrender to God? And how far does it go? Does it cover all of your being, all of your life? Faith surrenders to God's purposes. You must know that God's purpose always prevails, but faith stops fighting with Him. That's what faith does. Whatever else can be said about you, that's a different matter. But I do know that faith stops fighting with God. Have you surrendered to His will? Faith surrenders not only in death, it surrenders in life. Have you surrendered your life and your will to Jesus Christ? Don't wait until you die, because how do you know what will be? Faith surrenders to Jesus Christ, who sacrificed His own will to the Father, who surrendered even to the point of the cross, and by His once-for-all sacrifice has thrown open the gates of heaven for all who call on Him, all who trust in Him, all who are forgiven on account of Him, all who surrender to Him. It's an unbreakable chain, my friends. Faith surrenders. Verse 21 delivers a very similar scenario, so we can make this rather short. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. There are many similarities in this story. Perhaps the most salient one is that both of these men, Isaac and Jacob, father and son, when they came to that point in their lives when they pronounced the blessing on their posterity, they were both blind. Their eyesight was gone. So much so in the case of Jacob that when Joseph, his son, came to present his two sons, Manasseh, the firstborn, and Ephraim, the younger, he did not know who they were. And he asked Joseph, "Who are these?" Joseph, the father of these two boys, then places Manasseh on the right hand of Jacob, his father, and Ephraim, the younger, on the left hand of his father, so that he would put his hands on and bless them. And so Jacob mustered all the strength that was left in his dying body. He raises himself up on his bed and he crosses his hands and confers the blessing of the firstborn on the younger. And his father, like any good father, protested. He said, no, 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 no. This is the firstborn, not that one, this one. And all that Jacob can say is, I know. I know. And leaves the blessing with Ephraim. Now you can use your imagination in coming up with explanations as to why he did this or what he thought or how he could be so sure of what he was doing and whether you should try this at home. Don't. But at the end of the day, there is only one explanation. In its biblical context, all this means one very, very, very simple thing. Jacob surrendered to God's will. Jacob surrendered to God's way. Now, this is the man that you heard about this morning in the reading that Richard presented to you. This is the man who had stolen the right of the firstborn from Esau, his brother. And now he is standing before Joseph's sons, his grandsons, and acts contrary to human convention. Human convention which would have required that the firstborn gets the lion's share of the blessing. That was the way that people handled these things. He acts contrary to human convention because in all his years, he has learned the hard way through pain, through deprivation, through cold, through heat, through loss, that God's ways aren't our ways, and his thoughts aren't our thoughts. He surrenders to God's ways. He lets his hands be guided, as it were, and puts the blessing on the younger. For that is God's will. That was God's will. Don't ask me how he knew. I don't. You don't need to know. He knew. And in his case, the author makes his surrender even more explicit than in the first example by adding the notion that he was worshiping on the top of his staff. Worship. What is this? Worship is surrender, is ultimate surrender. And a worshipful death is beautiful. And I'm not saying this because I am morbid or I like to dwell on such things. I say this because every believer wants to see God justified. Everyone wants to see God worshipped in life or in death. And everyone wants to see God getting his due. This is right. And now think of Jacob. He knew the history of his own life, how he had used trickery to obtain the divine blessing, only to learn that God doesn't need it to accomplish his purposes. And now God has brought him all this way. God has brought him this far. And he has put him in the position to place the divine blessing on his posterity as an obedient vessel without fighting and without manipulation. There's only one way of saying it. For Jacob, God was the hero of his life, and to surrender to his will was sweeter than honey, better than life itself. Is that how you feel? God's purposes always prevail, and faith wants God to prevail. Isn't this true? It ought not to surprise you, knowing the gospel of Jesus Christ, who was crucified and raised from the dead. It ought not to surprise you when you consider that the first Christian interpretation of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ was coming in the form of a sermon preached by the Apostle Peter in the year of Christ's death and resurrection. And he said, Jesus was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. And you, the people of Jerusalem, you crucified and killed him by the hands of lawless men, but God raised him from the dead, loosing the pangs of death, for it was impossible that he should be held by them. The cross is the epitome of God's will prevailing over ours. Yes, even using the plots of evil men to make his will prevail through them. Worship God, my friend. Worship God. For faith surrenders in death and in life. But there's a third sketch. We move from faith that surrenders to faith that is sure. And it's a logical step, it's a logical progression, because how will you surrender by faith if you aren't sure of the outcome? How will you surrender to God if you do not know? Faith, therefore, is not only surrender, it is also the assurance of things hoped for. And so we read in verse 22, by faith Joseph, when he expired, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Joseph's faith in dying is bright and strong. Let's not forget, this man is Pharaoh's prime minister. Minus Pharaoh, that makes him the most powerful man in the known world. But it never meant much to him. At heart, he was always a servant of God, a Hebrew. And his hope was in the promise of God, nowhere else in this world, in the promise of God. And in full view, in embrace of that promise, he is now dying. Speaking of the future, Exodus. That was the anticipation of the people of God during that time. They were looking forward to being freed from slavery, led out of Egypt and into a land of promise. That was the horizon of their eschatology, if you will. This was the promise of God for the people of God. And Joseph was resolved that his bones shouldn't be buried in Egypt, but that they should be transported all the way to Canaan to be buried in that soil. Now, this may seem rather strange to you, for what difference does it make whether his bones are bleached in Egypt or in the land of Canaan? It's all the same. It all comes to the same. But this is Joseph's way of saying that he wants to be identified with God and with his promises. This is Joseph's way of saying that he wants to be with God and with his people. And this is his way of saying that he wants to participate in the future of God's people, even as a corpse, even in death. He wants to be where God will lead his people. How bright, how strong is his faith in dying, firmly fixed on the promise of God, fully assured of things hoped for. And these were his words to his people. God will surely visit you. And that's what faith does in the face of death. Faith does the only thing that you can do in dying. Trust in God's promise. For you have never gone this way before, and you will only go once. But you know where you are going, just as Joseph did. My bones are going to Canaan, to the promised land. And you see, without this assurance of things hoped for, surrender to God's will is little more than capitulation to a higher power, someone stronger than you. But with this assurance, surrender to God becomes something sweet. With the promise of God, it becomes sweet. Because you know the plans God has for you, plans for life and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Do you want to share in the future of God's people? Do you want to share in the kingdom of Jesus Christ? Only by faith. You will, but only